You're listening to the Fifth Estate podcast from the Wheeler Centre. This episode was recorded on the 8th of September 2020. It's called Breaking the Climate Stalemate.
My name is Sally Warhaft and I'm talking to you tonight from sad old Melbourne, but thrilled to bits to be with you. There have been few highlights during this pandemic lockdown, but one of them has been that, of course, new books and essays continue to be published. And tonight we have two really distinguished authors whose works have been one way or the other years in the making, but were both finished very recently during lockdowns with an awareness that the global pandemic that we're living with is going to also impact on climate change policy. Marion Wilkinson is one of Australia's great investigative journalists. She's a member of the Australian Media Hall of Fame, worked for the Sydney Morning Herald as its Washington correspondent, environment editor and deputy editor. She's also worked as a senior reporter and executive producer for the ABC's Four Corners. She was a co-author with David Marr of Dark Victory in 2003 and the author of The Fixer, The Untold Story of Graham Richardson. And her latest book is The Carbon Club, published by Allen and Unwin. Judith Brett is one of our most distinguished thinkers. She is Emeritus Professor of Politics at La Trobe University, a former editor of Meanjin, columnist for The Age. Judith won the National Biography Award in 2018 for the enigmatic Mr. Deacon. Her other books include From Secret Ballot to Democracy Sausage, Australian Liberals and the Moral Middle Class, and Robert Menzies' Forgotten People. She's the author of four quarterly essays, Relaxed and Comfortable, Exit Right, Fair Share, and her latest, The Coal Curse, Resources, Climate and Australia's Future, published, of course, by Black Ink. And to let you know before we go on that Readings Bookshop is our official bookseller for all of the Wheeler Centre's online events. So they can find you not just these recent publications, but all the back catalogue as well. Marion and Judith, welcome. Welcome to the Fifth Estate at the Wheeler Centre. It's really great to see you. Judith, of course, is in Melbourne as well, but Marion, you're brightening us all up with your reflected Sydney light. It's lovely to have you here. Let's begin because your stories come at the same problem in different ways and in very different time frames. So I'd like to begin by asking each of you, Marion, you can go first, about when the story begins for you in talking about climate change in Australia.
Well, I start my story back at the time of Kyoto. And the reason I wanted to do this is so many things came together at that time. It was a time when we definitively, I guess, decided that we were going to, as a country, align ourselves with essentially the Republican view on climate change coming out of the US. And the other thing that was very important to me was it was around Kyoto in 1997 that the dividing line really happened on science and the importance of the science skeptics. And early on in the book, I describe a conversation with one of America's leading climate change skeptics, and he explained that they had decided, the skeptic groups in America, that they had to challenge the science of climate change, otherwise basically the moral imperative of doing something would lie with the people who wanted to act on climate change. And that was a really big thing for them. And they engaged the Australian climate skeptics in that endeavour to basically question and challenge climate science. And that was all going on at the same time.
We'll come back to that really interesting aspect of your work about the relationship with the US. But Judy, over to you first.
Okay, well, I begin with wool. And because what I wanted to do with this essay was to try to put the sort of position that Australia's got to on climate change into a longer narrative of our economic history, because it seems to me that the fact that we're so dependent, we're a fossil fuel exporting nation or economy, explained a lot of the sort of political momentum behind where we got to. And why I said I begin with wool, I mean, Australia has basically as an exporting nation, or our exports have primarily been unprocessed primary commodities. So they started off with wool. When wool basically tanked in the 1950s, we were lucky enough that we had minerals. And so first iron ore and then coal and liquid natural gas. So, you know, replaced it. We stayed being a primary exporting unprocessed primary commodities. And so, and with a very weak manufacturing sector in terms of our exports. So that was this much longer time frame to try to, I wanted to some extent to move a little bit away from the sort of very detailed sort of work that Marion did, and so I think they dovetail very well to try to get a sense of where, of why, in terms of our history, why we've ended up where we are.
It's so interesting, that early history of protectionism too, that when you write about playing golf with a member of the tariff board could do more for a firm's prosperity than actually overseeing the development of a new product. And this idea that there's a long history really of resistance to change, I think, in Australia. But I wonder, Judy, if you can expand a bit on that quote, that idea, that because, and then for Marion to answer, is the Carbon Club sort of a modern version of that, that where these personal relationships can actually outbid science and what communities actually desire? Judy?
Yes, so the quote that Sally has, which comes from the period when Australia, after the Second World War, Australia decided that it needed to have a sophisticated manufacturing sector, which we basically, going into the Second World War, we didn't have. We also decided we needed a bigger population. And these two policies dovetailed. That if we were to have lots of people come here because we had to populate or perish, we had to have jobs for them. We were going to provide the jobs through expanding the manufacturing sector. Foreign companies were going to invest, and we were going to protect that manufacturing sector. The manufacturing was going to be for the domestic market, not for export. And that's the crucial point that I was trying to make. So that the companies were then protected by tariffs, and a huge amount of effort went into lobbying to get, you know, the tariffs on your shoes and particular machinery and that sort of thing. And even certainly from the early 60s, there was economists arguing that this was starting to really hold the Australian economy back because our manufacturing was protected, it was becoming uncompetitive in world terms. So Australians were paying a lot for products that were in some ways inferior. I remember when I went to England for the first time in the very early 1970s, the availability of clothes, you know, just all sorts of things, whereas now we have global brands, and you don't feel that, you know, being able to buy your clothes in London is going to make much difference. So, you know, and so that protection, and in a way you're right, like it was lobbying for keeping the politicians true to the creed of protection. That's what the manufacturers were focusing on, rather than developing their products.
And so, Marion, what you write about is this, this club of vested interests and individuals. I mean, there are some superstar individuals that have been able to really influence state policy for decades now. Tell us a bit more about how that has come to be.
Well, certainly in the early part of the book, in fact, right through to about the end of the Abbott era, I do think that one of the key figures in this was Hugh Morgan, who I know is very well known to you Melburnians, not so much in the rest of Australia. But Hugh Morgan's role was critical because I think a lot of people in the past have seen him as this godfather of the new right, if you like, in Australia, tilting at trade union rights and land rights and things like that. But I kind of try to reposition him a bit because he was utterly crucial in the hierarchy of the Liberal Party, both federally in Victoria and to some extent in Western Australia. And I remember one of his former colleagues that I interviewed saying to me that Hugh and his friends kind of epitomised the thinking of the Melbourne Club. They were utterly convinced that the wealth of the country, the power of the country, came from the resources sector and the fossil fuel industries or the industries, the mining interests that profited from the fossil fuel interests. And they did not want to be shifted on that, and they could not see another vision for Australia. And there was this very interesting meeting that a number of the senior leaders, business leaders, had with John Howard. I think it was around 2005. And the question was, which way Australia was going to go on its energy policy. And not only did they back expansion of the LNG industry, the liquefied natural gas industry, but they also absolutely disparaged the idea of looking at renewable energy as a possible way of lowering emissions on a large scale. And when I looked back, when I was writing the book, at the internal memos and notes on this that these executives produced, you could really see that the mentality was that they could not envisage a different path for Australia. And that's what I found so interesting. And that mentality really had seized, I think, the top of the Liberal Party, the National Party, and also significant elements of the Labor Party.
There was some...
That one of the things that's interesting there was at that moment that you're talking about, Marion, they believed that renewables would only really take off if there was a huge amount of government, if government policy promoted it and allowed it. And so it sort of fitted with their neoliberal ideology at that point, that we don't want the government interfering in the way in which the market is distributing resources. And I found that very interesting because, in fact, that's all changed now, because now renewables have fallen so much in price that they're now like people defending horses when the automobiles are on the road.
And the other thing that was so interesting was that they were so hostile to the idea of the government subsidising or creating policies to expand renewable energy that they felt was intervening in the market. But at exactly the same meetings, they were sitting there saying, why don't you put a whole heap of government dollars into carbon capture and storage for the coal industry? So there was this wonderful disconnect where if the subsidies were going to renewable energy, that was intervening in the market. If it was going to keeping the coal industry alive in the future with carbon capture and storage, that was a good investment of taxpayer dollars.
There was some dress rehearsal in some ways too for the climate campaign, the anti-climate campaign in Indigenous land rights as well, that sort of provided a model, was how I read this, for the campaign against climate action as well. Judy, do you want to talk about that?
Yes, I mean, I felt that, and living through the 1980s, it seemed to me that the mining industry and the Australian, what was it then called, the Australian Mining Industry Council, or the mining, anyway, keeps mining, what is it called now, the mining industry, anyway, that they had basically stopped the momentum of reconciliation in its tracks in the 80s and 90s. It's something that I think was unforgivable. But the thing about mining is it doesn't actually employ huge numbers of people, despite what you would think from Joel Fitzgibbon and co. So they embarked on a big public relations campaign to stop uniform land rights, which the legislation that the Labor government in the 1980s was considering would have given Indigenous owners much stronger rights in relation to what we can talk about as a veto right. They would be able to not give permission, to refuse permission for mining explorers to come onto their land. And this obviously was a huge threat to the mining industry, and they campaigned vociferously against it. They then campaigned against, after Mabo, they campaigned against Keating's native title legislation. And in doing that, they really honed their public relations skills, because what they had to do was to convince Australians that their interests in some way would actually be threatened by these things that were happening up in the Northern Territory or in Western Australia, far away from them. And we get, because Indigenous owners would have had slightly stronger property rights than ordinary Australians, because with freehold title, miners can come in, as many farmers are finding out, and explore and mine. We had the beginning of this, the rule of law should be the same for everybody, no special rights for Indigenous Australians. And it was extraordinarily successful, you know, that they, something that was actually about defending a very, their vested interests got turned into a general narrative about there should be no special treatment for Indigenous Australians. And they really honed their public relations skills. They've got deep pockets. They ran huge, you know, they ran television ads, campaigns. And it finished with, you know, John Howard holding up a map of Australia and saying, all of this will be under native title, won't be able to mine, you won't, the state governments won't have money to pay for schools. You know, they were extraordinarily successful. And it gave them the confidence, I mean, it gave them skills and the confidence that they could win, you know, that they could actually turn a political movement around.
This really caught my interest in both of your works, this how emboldened, you know, and you think about the one that always gets me is the mining tax, the super mining tax that Rudd and Swan tried to introduce, and that, you know, the majority of Australian people end up saying, no, we don't want to tax the incredibly rich mining sector to benefit us all. I mean, it's like a sort of form of magic, but of course it's not magic. And the story of the Indigenous land rights connection was interesting to me, and as to really interesting, Marion, this connection with the US, that this is actually a very slick playbook, and where the connections are very much there between individuals, organisations, institutions, in order to make sure that Australia, well, never has an effective climate change policy. Were you surprised, Marion, at the extent of those connections?
Well, I had gone to Washington to do some interviews around this, because I knew that this was a very, very big part of what happened in Australia. But some some of the key players in this, people like Corey Bernardi, were willing to sit down with me and go through what happened at the time, particularly during the campaigns against Malcolm Turnbull, Kevin Rudd and Julia Gillard, and also one of his colleagues in the US, Tim Andrews, who'd worked or had been trained at the Koch Brothers Training Institute in Washington. And they sort of explained the strategy to me. And I was surprised how deeply rooted it was within the Republican right, but also in those right-wing, very successful conservative lobby groups in Washington. And this, to me, became very interesting when I began reading some of the speeches that were delivered to defeat Obama's climate agenda and the congressional climate agenda in Washington. And almost some of the same words, the same phraseology was being used against Rudd in Canberra and then Gillard in Canberra. That, to me, was very interesting. And the ties on both sides were in a way much deeper than I realised at the time.
There's so many opportunities that have gone to waste in this story. And I always think of when Rudd and Turnbull were the leaders of their respective parties, that for that, 5 minutes we had the two sort of intellectuals of their parties, the two outsiders of their parties, that in some ways these unusual aspects gave an opportunity, of course, that completely fell apart. Today, Kevin Rudd writing in the newspaper that, Scott Morrison will be desperately hoping for a Trump victory in the United States, because otherwise Australia is going to be left on its own as a sort of middling country in this story. How much do the individuals matter, and how much of it is a structural and peculiarly Australian culture, do you think? Marion, perhaps you first.
Very big question.
Clearly it's both. But individuals are very, very important, as we saw in Malcolm Turnbull's case. And the passions that were unleashed about Turnbull's removal first in 2009, that really surprised me. Even now, going back interviewing the key players who were involved, there was an absolute overwhelming position that he was driving what they saw as this huge green agenda in the Liberal Party. They felt this was foreign to the Liberal Party and it had to be removed. And one of the things that really struck me in this is that you have these individual forces who come along and actually try to change the history on this, but there is a structure there, and that structure is, of course, the vested interests of all the corporations, the workers, the towns, the regions that all depend on fossil fuel industries and all the economies that are around them. So what I thought happened in the end was that key players in what I call the Carbon Club would come and go depending on whether the legislation or the program or the policy going through disrupted their vested interests. But then at the core, you had individuals driving the case not to change. And that is how I'd see it.
I think Kevin Rudd has to take some responsibility too for the breakdown with Turnbull. He basically he pushed Turnbull too hard. He thought, that the Liberal Party would split on it, which it did, and that somehow, he put politics ahead. So that 5 minute moment that was there when Turnbull still had more authority, I think he delayed. But I would then say, that being the case, the fossil fuel, capital is deserting fossil fuels, so that for all of the individual triumphs that the Carbon Club has had, they've delayed things, but they haven't actually stopped what I think is probably a fairly inevitable change. And Australia is going to be in a really bad position unless we get some good leadership on this. Because if the world, or, you know, as the rest of the world wakes up to the really serious catastrophes that we're likely to face, there will be a move away from fossil fuels. And we haven't been prepared for it. We haven't had our governments leading us to develop replacement industries. It's like we hoped that the world would keep wearing wool and sleeping under wool blankets for the next decades, but it didn't, you know? So I think that there are bigger historical forces at work, both the realization about what's happening with the climate, but also there's now a technological imperative that's driving the uptake of renewables, because it's actually turning out to be much, much, much cheaper than was ever envisaged back in 2009, 2010. And I think this is pretty unstoppable. That's where the new entrepreneurial energy is. That's where the excitement is, and that's where capital is starting to move to. So I think in the end, for all they did, you know, they will be just looked on as people who actually probably damaged Australia's long-term future.
Judy, you wrote that just as important as the deniers are the minimisers, the people that have been really successful in creating a belief that the science is contestable. In some ways, that seems to have been one of the greatest wins of the people that don't want to see a climate change policy. This idea that the science is up for grabs, which so many institutions, including Marion, the ABC, I think, for a long time bought into but grappled with. You know, do we need to have a denier to balance, this person who's promoting the science? That it allowed the idea of it being contestable to be discussed. Now, I keep imagining if this was the case with the coronavirus, and what a government, the federal government response, if it had been similar to the science of this virus, what might it have looked like, Judy, do you think?
Well, look, I was just going to say another point before you got onto that, which is I think what was very clever about that is that was that idea that somehow we have to keep an open mind, you know, scepticism, linked in with ideas about freedom of speech, that somehow, you know, so it linked to another value that a lot of, you know, that's very important for our democracy. But it was epistemologically naive, you know, like we don't, every time we get into an aeroplane, we don't think, let's have a bit of a debate about, you know, the science of aerodynamics. It was a very cynical move, I always thought, that played, I mean, most people don't know a lot about science. You know, and as you're saying with the coronavirus, we're trusting the scientists. But I think it was that link in with ideas about freedom of speech and of course, at some level, there's things about science that are always contestable, but there's all sorts of things that aren't contestable. And I thought it was mischievous in many ways, but it was also sort of ignorant. I put it in the same category as the arguments about whether or not climate change causes bushfire, as if the only cause of a bushfire is whoever lit the match or the lightning strike. You know, that of course there's many, causation is quite a complex thing, and there was that similar incredible sort of naivety that people like Tony Abbott and Peter Dutton were pursuing. Probably, you know, it shows their lack of philosophical reflection and sophistication, but it was, it's plausible to a lot of people, those sorts of arguments. So back on the coronavirus, I mean, I think that's hopeful in a way. At least the politicians have stopped knocking science because they've actually realised how much the sort of very interdependent industrial society we've got, and with the high levels of global mobility, how much we're actually going to be, we're very dependent on this extremely high level sophisticated science to protect us from the coronavirus.
Do you agree that it's a potential circuit breaker, that, you know, we've all been reminded how important science is. We've all been reminded about how many things in Australia we no longer can make for ourselves, like surgical masks for the first half of this year and ventilators. And mind you, we've pivoted to being able to do it, which is impressive. But are you optimistic or pessimistic that when this nightmare is over, everybody will want to just be clutching to it, just get back to where we were, and that the idea that, you know, we're going to create a brand new, glorious, community-driven, wonderful, self-sustaining future is just something that Melbourne people talk about because they can't go out anymore?
Well, look, I think one of the things there that you alluded to, Sally, that I think the COVID pandemic has done is it's really revealed the weakness of our manufacturing sector. You know, when I started the quarterly essay, started thinking about it back last, I was going to say last century, feels like that, the end of last year, people weren't talking about how we couldn't make anything. But now with since COVID, we've been talking about it a lot, and I think it's been a real shock. And we've now got an industry minister, Karen Andrews, who is actually, I think she's an engineer.
She's an engineer,
you know,
she's
really focused on engineering, and she seems to actually get it in a way that I've felt that the Liberals have been incredibly weak on industry policy, really, certainly ever since, well, they were pretty weak under Howard, but they certainly under Abbott, since Abbott has basically seemed to have disappeared. So I think that's quite hopeful. You know, she's quite hopeful and sort of serious, and she's not a climate change ideologue.
How remarkable that somebody actually linked to their portfolio in their expertise could be doing a noticeably good job.
Well, I think that we're going into a very interesting debate on this, and I think this will play out especially in October and November this year when we see the budget and when we see Angus Taylor's technology roadmap. There is, I think, at the moment a feeling that part of the country really wants to go down the gas-led recovery route, and I think we're hearing this in the media all the time. Obviously, people in the press gallery are being briefed on this. Some of the union leaders have come out strongly for it. On the other hand, we're seeing both some state Liberal politicians, some Labor politicians, and certainly key business figures saying exactly what Judith was saying before. We want to see a different Australia. We want to have a vision of a different Australia which moves to a clean energy economy and a manufacturing industry that's potentially powered by a clean energy economy. That debate, I think, is going to really play out over the next year, and where that goes for me is going to be probably the determining, at least for this government, the determining time when we see whether we're going to go back to the future of what we've had, both under John Howard and Tony Abbott, or whether we're going to go in a new direction. And a lot, I think, will hang on that.
And I think it's not just about manufacturing here. The other, I think, really quite exciting possibility that's now on the table is that we can become an energy exporter by exporting renewable energy. So Mike Cannon-Brookes has invested heavily in this huge solar farm outside of Tennant Creek, and the idea is that the energy that's made there, renewable energy, will go by cable to Singapore. And just today in the paper, he was talking about the fact that we could have a cable that linked Western Australia, where the sun shines for 3 hours longer than it does over here in on the east, so that when we're all cooking our dinner and things between, you know, 5 and 8 at night, the sun's still shining over there, and so renewable energy can be piped over here. So, and Ross Garnaut's also talked about this idea that we can become an energy superpower. So it's like, okay, we went from wool to minerals, and we could go from minerals to renewable energy. So we would still be an energy exporting nation, but we would be exporting renewable energy, and we would still be using our natural resources, but we'd be using wind and sun. And it, because it follows the sort of economic logic of the way in which our economy has worked, I think it's got a lot, it's very powerful. And capital is moving that. I mean, so, you know, Angus Taylor can be going around briefing the journalists all he likes, but it's also where people making investments are going to making their decisions. And just on another thing, I mean, it seems to me that's probably or perhaps one of the reasons that the Liberals are going after the superannuation funds is that that superannuation funds are now big capital investors, and some of them are starting to put pressure on things on companies about their climate policies. You know that this is capital, that it's capital that is actually controlled more by progressives than the Liberals are used to seeing. And there's a lot of this investor activism now. You know, and so I sort of feel as if they're still very, you know, it's quite right, the fossil fuel industry is still very powerful, but they're pushing back now. They're holding back the dike in some way, you know, that's me being optimistic.
And a potential too that, you know, these carbon-based tariffs from other countries, particularly the EU,
exactly,
were looking to come into play before the next meeting, was it in Glasgow or somewhere, was postponed. Do you share that optimism, Marion? And also, how dependent is it on this election in the United States, that, you know, if Donald Trump were to win a second term, Australia then has this great ally in its do nothing climate change policy? How much is dependent on that?
I think so much is dependent on that at the moment. I think if Trump does win the White House again, that this will create big problems for any ideas about carbon tariffs. I think you just have to look at the way the European countries have had such difficulty with trying to reform the power and the taxation, tax evasion and avoidance policies of the big American tech companies, to see the EU constantly butting up against the White House on this. If Trump does get returned to the White House, I think it will put back the climate policy in Australia and globally quite a bit, because the other point, of course, is that China will and India, but China in particular, will not feel that pressure coming from the US. On the other hand, if Biden does win the election, his climate change program is in fact going to be quite problematic for Australia, because it does also look at carbon tariffs. But quite interestingly, the other point in there is that it looks to providing support for legal cases in the courts against companies that do pursue profit at the expense of emissions targets and at the expense essentially of action on climate change. If that happens, that's going to put a lot of pressure on Australian companies, and, you know, Australian exports. So I think that a Biden presidency will have a big impact on what happens in climate policy here.
And the carbon clubs seem fairly immune to international shaming. And in fact, Australian, you know, certain sections of Australian politics do. A dark victory 17 years ago reminds us of that. But when it hits the bottom line, when it affects the implications for trade, that does seem to be a sort of potential area, Judy, where we could well be forced into it. Is that your reading?
Yes, I mean, and like, it's just hard to read. I find Scott Morrison quite hard to read on this in many ways because I don't think he's particularly ideological. He seems to me a bit of a sort of policy neutral zone in many ways. So I think that I think he's quite capable of pivoting on this in a way that somebody like Tony Abbott and John Howard weren't. So that if the external environment changed radically, he may change. You know, like people have put a lot on the COVID commission that he appointed, and we don't know what the process was of appointment. It just seemed to sort of appear like a jack in a box almost. And it struck me that it was something that he hadn't put, that wasn't very thoughtfully done. You know, there was no representatives from the service sector. There was none of the younger entrepreneurs on it. It was like he, you know, it just seemed a bit reactive. So, I mean, I guess, you know, we just have to wait and see what happens with America. But we're also running out of time, you know, that in terms of the way the climate's changing. And so I thought that Marion might have been going to say when she said about, you know, depends what happens in October, November, depends whether we get another lot of bushfires. I mean, I think I saw there were bushfires in New South Wales again already.
In Ballarat today.
Oh, was it Ballarat? I knew there was bushfires somewhere. Mm. So, you know, we're talking about trends with all of these things. That's hard for people to understand. But I think the evidence, the cumulativeness of these bushfire seasons is starting to really freak people out and make them realise there is something serious happening with the climate. So, you know, that's another sort of pressure that's coming in on us.
I guess for me, in looking at this over a period of the last 20 years, the question that I was left with by the end of the book was what sort of time frame are the Australian politicians and Australian business and Australian banks, what time frame are they looking at? Because what was made clear at the last climate conference in Madrid, what's been made clear in the last IPCC reports, what's been made clear in the last CSIRO and Bureau of Meteorology reports here on the state of our climate, is that essentially we are looking at this decade, these 2020s, to decide whether we're serious about this aim of trying to keep the temperature will rise well below 2 degrees. And so whenever I hear people say, look, let's go for the 2050 carbon neutral target, the New South Wales government's done it, the Business Council of Australia's done it, the Farmers Federation has done it, I actually want to know what the 2030 targets are. And I think once we start talking about that in Canberra, in the Morrison government, in, you know, not the current targets we have, but real 2030 targets. And once we start talking about that in the Business Council and the Minerals Council, then I think I will believe that we're actually going to have a real debate on this by both parties in this, both major parties in this country.
9 years away, and we're in the greatest global economic shock in, you know, decades and decades, and we don't know when it's going to end. I find it so difficult to imagine at the moment there's going to be room for this to take priority in the years to come, particularly in a country like Australia with our history on this issue, that what we're going to hear about is rebuilding the economy, and it's going to be about going back to the tried and true, digging stuff out of the ground and sending it off to reboot other people's economies as well. It's so hard for me to imagine that this conversation could take centre stage in the time frame you've just mentioned, Marion. Is there something I'm missing other than, of course, the incredible urgency of it, for this to take place? Is there something I'm, Judy, perhaps you can, make me feel better. I'm sorry to be the pessimist, but I'm deeply pessimistic about this.
Yes, I mean, I find, like when I read the papers every morning, that I fluctuate between pessimism and optimism. You know, there's things there for both. Look, we can still be digging iron ore out of the ground, and iron ore is now really our only export staple apart from the fossil fuels, because COVID has done for the international education and for tourism for the foreseeable future. I think maybe what you're missing is the flight of capital from fossil fuels. If we were in an authoritarian society, we'd have no hope, because we'd have a government that would just defend the way things were. But actually, they don't control the whole of the economy, and capital is deserting fossil fuels at a very great rate and moving towards renewables. Now, in Australia, that could be helped by government policy, but it's sort of happening anyway. So whether it's going to happen fast enough, I mean, I feel deep down quite pessimistic, but one has to live with hope and optimism, because you can't function and you can't, enjoy children and, enjoy life in a way. But I think that is perhaps what you're missing, is that we're not in an authoritarian society and the government doesn't call all the shots on this.
It's a slightly alarming answer, isn't it? the incredible need for us to all, wherever we are in the world, protect our democracies, no matter how strong and robust we think they are. Marion, can you come up with anything slightly more? Without wanting to, I don't want to do that thing where you have a conversation about a terrible problem for an hour and then you just sign off on the hopeful note, because otherwise people will be crying. That's not what I'm asking for, because the answer might be no, you don't,
No, I am incredibly optimistic. And one of the things I think that happens, especially in the climate change area, you go along, and this is what I found when I was researching the book, you go along for a few years and you think things are absolutely going nowhere. In the Howard period, in the Abbott period, and then suddenly, kaboom, something happens and you get this huge burst of activity and involvement and engagement, not only by the public, which has a huge influence on the politicians, but by business as well. And I think we certainly saw that after the bushfires here, as Judith mentioned, and had it not been for the COVID pandemic, I think that we would have seen a lot more flow from that. But equally, I think even in Howard's time, we saw the way he had to turn on a dime in a sense, because of the drought, because of the impact of that, but also things like, the Al Gore movie and the enormous public pressure. We saw Tony Abbott put under pressure because Obama managed to do a deal with President Xi over climate in the lead up to Paris. So you see these things and you see that actually a lot can happen in a short period of time, even after years of inertia. And I think that the change will become more and more rapid. And in fact, I only have to look at my poor benighted industry of journalism. You know, when I was still at the Sydney Morning Herald, it was an incredibly wealthy newspaper, as was The Age, making buckets of money from their classified ads. That all turned very quickly, but the media survived. We're remaking ourselves. And I think Australia will remake itself and has enormous opportunities, but you have to bring people with you, and you have to bring all those small communities in regional Australia with you, because otherwise, as I show quite painfully in the book, they're the people who get wedged. That's where the really brutal politics and toxic politics of climate change gets really exploited. So, I am definitely optimistic.
There's a ton of detail in your book, The Carbon Club. Actually, you just mentioned Al Gore before and reminded me of that, the scenes with Clive Palmer and Al Gore, which I'll leave people to read in the book. I mean, honestly, you just need a shower after reading that. It was, about the deals that people have to do and the compromises. It's what it's going to be about in the end, this, and Judy, you point that out in your essay. It's about some sort of compromise, but some of them are a bit more grubby than others, aren't they? The coal curse. Resources, climate, and Australia's future. Judy's quarterly essay, The Carbon Club, at the Readings Bookshop. Go online, and they will send them out to you beautifully. And they really are wonderful to read together. It was a deep dive back into the history, but also the culture and this very particular Australian story, isn't it, that hopefully will be resolved with the kind of tenacity and brains that, you know, we seem to be bringing on the whole to the COVID-19 problem. And perhaps I can take some optimism in that as well. It's a great thrill to see the two of you together for the conversation tonight, and I really, really appreciate it, and I'm sure everybody watching does as well. And don't forget, everyone who's watching, to go to the Wheeler website as well, because there is an archive there that could keep you through a lockdown for eternity. And there is something there for every mood, every evening. So check out the Wheeler website and Readings, and you'll be completely sorted. Judith Brett, Marion Wilkinson, thank you so much, and hopefully we can come together in person with our beloved audience not too far down the track. We miss you so much at the Wheeler Centre, every one of us. So take care until we're all together, and we'll see you soon. Good night.